Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Ani, and welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David Dry, speaking to you from Catawba Territory, and today we have the pleasure to be talking with Thomas Lapas about his new book, In League Against King Alcohol, Native American Women and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, 1874 to 1933. The book, published in 2020 by the University of Oklahoma Press, explores the largely untold story of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in Indian Country. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could start things off by telling us a little about yourself and your background as a scholar, teacher, and writer.
Okay, sure. So I originally started out my scholarly life as a colonialist. And I guess even back when I was an undergraduate, I went to Kenyon College in Gambier, Ohio. And I became very interested in the relationship between Native Americans of New France and Northern New England, or what was New France and New England in the colonial era, and the interplay between the Native communities there and primarily the Jesuits, as well as the New England missionaries. And my dissertation was originally a biography of a Jesuit missionary and his relationship with the Abenaki or Wabanaki communities of what's now Northern Maine and Southern Canada. And so a long story, a little bit short, is when I got my first job, I got a job as a colonial historian at Nazareth College. And I started a project on what was still early America on, I thought my dissertation was going to be published as a book, you know, and that's what most normal people do, right? Is their dissertation becomes their first book. And I was working on that, kind of editing that up, adding some things, fixing some things, getting ready for that to be the first, you know, the first manuscript that went out. And I started a second project, but I knew I was going to have to kind of stay local. So I was very interested in the relationship between the labor of the Erie Canal, the Erie Canal building process, and the potential for Native American labor, because of course the Erie Canal was essential or was a key factor in the displacement of the Seneca people whose territory we're in right now in Rochester. So I started looking at kind of close-up records dealing with the canal construction period. And that really brought me into the 1820s, 1830s. And I started finding all these connections to or references to the Six Nations Temperance Society or the Temperance Society of the Iroquois. And this was something coming as a, you know, as a colonialist, as an early Americanist, I knew about Handsome Lake and his prophecies and visions that led to the Gaiwito or the Longhouse tradition. But I didn't know anything about this, what seemed to be a kind of Christian temperance organization. And so I sort of, in some ways, I shifted my research trajectory from being primarily a colonialist to somebody who was really interested in what was the 19th and going into the 20th century. So I magically became a 19th century historian. I guess my book, since it goes into 1933, somehow I'm a modern historian too. So my trajectory is a little non-traditional in that sense.
And one of the remarkable things, you mentioned you were trying to stay local, but one of the remarkable things about the book is the wide array of archival materials you bring together to tell this story. Could you talk a little bit about making the book and some of the tribal groups and regions that feature prominently?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. And here's where I have the potential to go really long here. So feel free to interrupt as I do. So this this started out as I said, a local, really local. So I was finding material about the Seneca communities and Tuscarora communities. In fact, the Tuscarora Nation today still hosts the Six Nation Temperance Society meetings. Primarily, probably the most active. I was finding sources and people who were related to the temperance movement in Seneca reservations and out of Tuscarora. And then I found kind of a gold mine at the Onondaga County Historical Society, which is in Syracuse, and that's 4 miles north of the Onondaga Nation. And the archive there had a series of newspaper accounts relating to the temperance movement on Onondaga. And the woman there was a woman named Elizabeth or Eliza Pierce. And she was involved with a lot of the major temperance groups. So she was a member of the IOGT, or Independent Order of Grand Templars, which was actually started in central New York State. She was a member of that organization. She was a member of the WCTU. She was a member of the Six Nations Temperance Society. She was involved in a number of kind of scandals on the reservation that made it to the news. So there was a lot of kind of biographical material about her. So in this process, I said, okay, well, I don't know anything. I really don't know anything about the Women's Christian Temperance Union at all. So in that process of trying to find out more about them, I connected with a couple local people, local scholars, who had done some stuff in the WCTU. And they kind of told me how to read the records, and they pointed me to the microfilm series, which has the national annual meeting minutes, and it has the Union Signal, which was a weekly newspaper or news magazine that the WCTU published, and still technically it still publishes it, but it's not nearly as comprehensive. And I started reading, so I literally started just ordering the microfilm and reading them from start to finish. There's the finding aid only exists in Evanston; they haven't been digitized yet. And so the only way you can really get at small details is to read through everything, kind of scanning. And I ended up getting glasses staring at the microfilm machine so much. But I started collecting, I started looking primarily at New York State to try to find references to particular communities that I knew were close to reservations. And I found stuff. I found references to that kind of formed the basis of the book. So I found a lot of material about Seneca Nation at Allegheny in particular, but a little bit at Cattaraugus, and then a lot in Onondaga and a lot in Tuscarora. And so that really started the process for me was in New York State. Now, then I went to Evanston, which is the center of the WCTU's world. It is still the home of the Francis Willard Memorial Library and Archives. And it is the place where the Union Signal was published. So they have all of the national records there. And then all the state records, as state unions largely go defunct, the state records get sent to the WCTU archives there. And so there's a big compendium, I guess you could say, of the state records that are there. But almost more importantly, there's archivists. And the archivists at the Francis Willard Memorial Library were really helpful in helping me to understand just how the WCTU worked, how it was organized, more about Francis Willard. And so what I then started doing is I started looking through the state records that they had in the archives. And I was there really only for a few days, but I began to realize how the state records were organized. Now, again, they were published, but they certainly weren't widely reproduced, and they were very limited. They were very limited in Evanston. So I applied for a grant from the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation, actually. They have a research grant for social science research into alcohol and addiction. And I started to, I took kind of what I knew about how New York State records were organized, that there were little tidbits in these national records in the annual meeting minutes and in the Union Signal, and that there might be a state level annual meeting minute that was published. There may have even been a state newspaper. New York State published one, but the records for that are very spotty, believe it or not, even though New York State was one of the biggest WCTU unions. And then there would be, the states would often publish these kind of biographies or histories of the women who were in their organization or the organizations themselves. And so these were the three big kinds of sources that existed outside of the national ones, which were on microfilm. So I developed, I guess you'd call it a method, was I tried to track down every state where there was a major Native American population. I tracked down in the various libraries, archives, state, you know, university record, university libraries, or state historical associations, wherever there was a WCTU collection. I just kind of tracked down, all right, what do you have the Union State, do you have their state newspaper? Do you have their state annual meeting minutes? Do you have any additional sources, other, you know, records that somebody, somebody left the states when their WCTU union went defunct, did they empty out grandma's attic and kind of transfer these to the university or the state historical society? And basically that's where I, you know, took the show on the road. And so I went to the upper Midwest first, and I went, in 2016, I went to, you know, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and made another trip to Evanston that year. And I found out that this works, that I was able to kind of, the way I described it is, you know, some people are looking for a needle in a haystack. I was looking for a lot of needles under a lot of different haystacks. But in every archive I went to, as I read through the newspapers, there were little references to a Native American community, either a boarding school, a town that was next to a reservation, or a town that existed where a reservation had previously been. Or in the case of, you know, depending on where you are in Oklahoma, a place that was Native American territory but wasn't reservation territory, or in California, what you had was a situation where the Native American population was doubly disenfranchised, and that they were they did not have reservation land where they would have access to kind of federal education at some level. And they were also discriminated against in kind of the state public school system. And so in California, there was a fight for not just the WCTU, but the Women's National Indian Association to fight to reclaim, to reacquire land for the tribes in California. So in those places, because there was a fight or a dispute, and claims, and there were reform organizations, they left records. And so throughout the country, I took the work that came out of the Upper Midwest research trip. I applied for a grant through the Louisville Institute, which exists for the study of the church in North America. And since the WCTU is, you know, first and foremost a Christian temperance union, they were generous enough to finance the big Western trip. And that saw the pockets of Oklahoma, a lot of activity in California, a lot of activity in Washington State, and then, you know, smaller stories in Montana and Idaho, but nonetheless kind of important to the overall picture of the WCTU was involved in Native American communities all over the country. And certainly the pockets were in New York State, Oklahoma, California, Washington State. These were kind of the hotbeds. But at the same time, they attempted to go anywhere there was a Native American community. They attempted to reach out. And furthermore, Native American women in their communities, if they had come into contact with WCTU leaders or missionaries who were connected to them, or if they found out through their boarding school experiences. Native American women reached out to the WCTU unions themselves also. So that's a little bit of an overview of kind of how this went from a local to a really broad national project. And so I kind of tricked myself into making it the exact opposite of the local project I thought it was going to be. And it ended up taking me all around the country.
Well, you ended up with a wonderful result. And the book, of course, explores the various layers of the organization and these various regions that you visited. And I wonder if you could first give us the perspective of the national leadership and how outreach to Indians fit into their general goals and mandate.
Yeah, so this was fascinating to me. And there's a couple key leaders. I guess I'll try to focus it on a couple key leaders. And the first one we have to talk about is Frances Willard, who really defines the organization. She is the second president of the WCTU. She's president for almost 20 years. And she changes it from an organization that's just focused on temperance to one that's focused on any social reform movement that can tangentially help the temperance movement. So this meant suffrage, but this also meant child labor. It meant anti-cigarette smoking. And they also had many departments under her. They created departments of outreach. So there was a department among lumbermen. There was a department among miners. And so they organized initiatives to send people out to these particular communities. And initially, the department of work among the Chinese, Indians, and colored people. And so you see a sense of kind of, well, they're taking, it's a classic example of just looking at, lumping the others all into one category or one department. And very early on, after about a year or two of experimenting with that as a department, they break it apart. They just recognize that, okay, very, very clearly there's a problem. There's a problem with doing this. Even if our goal is transformation and assimilation, there's just distinctiveness among these communities. And so Willard herself goes through a transformation, I think. And she goes to what is then Indian territory at least twice in her life. But even before she goes there, she comments. I talk a little bit about this, I think, primarily in chapter three, where I talk about how the WCTU writes about Native Americans almost from a literary perspective. And early on in Willard's writings, she really uses American Indian people as kind of a literary trope, that they are emblematic of savagery and brutality, and that civilization in general is going to be something that is going to transform them. And she's come into almost no contact with Native peoples at all at this point. Now she uses them as metaphor. She talks about the people who are displaced from California, the Modocs, who end up in Indian territory. She talks about them in just outright ethnocentric, if not just plain racist ways. Then she takes a trip to Indian territory. And I think during this period of time, I think at some level, she comes into contact with the diversity of Native American peoples, and she hears stories. She hears stories of displacement. She travels primarily through what is Indian territory proper, the eastern portion of what is now Oklahoma. And so she's coming into contact with primarily Cherokee and Creeks, and primarily the more assimilated members of those communities. And while she retains much of her ethnocentrism, I think she gets a more complicated picture of Native American communities. So I think at one level, Willard changes a little bit. Now she's not going to escape her 19th century Anglo-centric roots and the limitations that are on almost everybody from that period of time. And she's not kind of embedded in a Native American community for any real length of time. But I do see her going through a subtle change, but her perception of what should happen in Native American communities remains fairly firm. That is, she sees conversion to Christianity, absorption into the broader Euro-American economic system. She sees these as the things that the WCTU should be pursuing with Native communities. There's a sensitivity or desire to make sure that Native Americans have some land base, but that there's an assumption that that land base is then going to be allotted, so that individual people will own the land rather than tribes in common. So she definitely sees tribal, she doesn't see tribes as something that are going to continue to exist politically, which of course is going to contrast from what I see is a lot of Native American women who are in the organization who don't necessarily give up on that. Even if allotment happens, they see a border around Native American communities as being something that could still exist. So a combination of private property and at the same time, Indian homelands going on at the same time. I think that's one place where Native American women and the WCTU leadership are going to differ. The other woman who really deserves a great deal of mention is Dorcas Spencer. And Dorcas Spencer gets involved very early in what they call Indian work. And so she is primarily from California, and she helps to form the Northern branch, the Northern California branch of the WCTU. So she's deeply involved in temperance from very early on. She is involved in the Hoopa Valley Indian Reservation. She's involved with a guy named Billy Beckwith, who has connected with her in order to try to push out a military base that's there. And so she learns a lot from Beckwith about the iniquities that happen when you have a primarily male military base on or near a Native American community who's vulnerable, and the relationship of alcohol to the abuse that happens. Violence against women, violence against the Indian community more broadly. And so she's much sharper in understanding exactly the impact that alcohol is going to portray and play in exacerbating some of the problems on the reservations. Now, Spencer, over the course of her time, what I find fascinating about Spencer is that although she is going to travel almost as much as Willard does to Native American communities all around the country. So Spencer's going to be in Arizona, New Mexico, Oklahoma, certainly all over California. She's going to make it to New York State. She's going to meet with Lydia Pierce. And she will speak very affectionately of the Native American women who are in the organization and the efforts that they're making. There's still quite a bit of condescension in the way that she writes about Native American women, almost kind of patting them on the back for doing things that I guess she's a little surprised at how organized they'll be. The language they used was parliamentary usage, which was actually another department that was established in the WCTU. But it basically meant did they run meetings by Robert's Rules of Order? And a lot of Native American women, especially those who went to either boarding schools or Euro-American day schools, you know, they were bilingual. They were often biliterate, depending on the community that they were in. And so just following Robert's Rules of Order was kind of one of the things that you might have done in the clubs in those schools. So there was a little bit of condescension when she talked about how Native American women would run meetings or how organized they were. Or how well they wrote or spoke. But there was nonetheless a sense of admiration. But even Spencer, for all of her understanding of kind of the devastation of white policy, of the problems of warfare, the Indian office that she looked at, it wasn't assimilation that she was opposed to. It was either graft or duplicitousness of Indian agents who maybe were dealing alcohol or even bringing alcohol onto the reservation. She would often gripe about those kinds of things, corruption in the Indian office, rather than the assimilation policy itself, which, of course, was part of the WCTU's efforts. So I think if you look at Spencer and Willard as kind of, you know, very powerful individuals who are emblematic of what the WCTU's overall view of Native Americans was. They were definitely committed to assimilation. At times, there are criticisms of federal Indian policy, removal, how that unfolded. Any policy that ended up, like, so for allotment, the biggest problem with allotment was how it unfolded often when Native Americans received title to the land and then were able to sell the land to whites. They were often upset that Native Americans lost their individual plots, but they weren't necessarily upset over the breaking up of tribal political organization or social cultural organization. So they were kind of critical of many things that I think a lot of modern scholars and Native American people from that time through the present would be critical of. But at the same time, they didn't often challenge the overall assimilation policies of the federal government.
And could you talk a little bit more about those connections to assimilation policies? In particular, I'm thinking of your last chapter on Indian boarding schools.
Yeah. So the boarding school chapter, the boarding schools I found to be very, I mean, they're obviously interesting in a lot of ways, and they're obviously terrible in a lot of ways. What I found was interesting about Native American children who were involved in these, in the temperance organizations at the school, I think two things. One is from the WCTU's organizational perspective, and where women really did have a lot of kind of clout in the 19th century is with educational policy. Obviously, school board elections are one of the first elections that women were allowed to vote in the United States. There's a sense of child rearing as part of the cult of true womanhood. You know, child rearing was an expectation or a venue or route that was encouraged for women. So where the WCTU saw a lot of success was in the implementation of the scientific temperance instruction. They got that into the federal Indian boarding schools from a fairly early stage. By the, in the 1880s, the superintendent of Indian Affairs, brought that into the Indian schools and then kind of followed up. That is, or he claimed to follow up to make sure that this instruction was taught. And there were certain textbooks that were recommended by the WCTU, and they ended up in the boarding schools. So they were. They were influential at affecting the curriculum in the boarding schools. And from a Native American, from the children's perspective, trying to get in as somebody who's a teacher of, you know, I teach college age children, but there's in a fairly democratic society, there's still an element of coercion, right? When you're teaching, you're wondering, well, these students just parroting back to me what I expected them to, what I told them to say, or are they actually coming up with their own ideas? And so what happens is the children who are in the boarding schools, they write either assignments, and in some boarding school records, we have remnants of the assignments. We have remnants of speeches, you know, valedictory speeches or speeches that were delivered at what were called the medal contests. These were the Loyal Temperance Legion, which was the kids group of the WCTU. They often gave, they had medal contests, and sometimes the speeches for those medal contests were preserved. And then in the newspapers, the student newspapers at Haskell or Carlisle and Sherman Indian School, we have the remnants of some of the newspapers. And in the columns, students wrote stuff. And then the other thing is that sometimes the student newspapers from one place, from one boarding school, they would receive some of the news that was happening at another boarding school. And so they would reprint some of the stories. So trying to, asking the question, to what extent were Native American children or young adults, were they absorbing the message of the WCTU? Were they absorbing temperance? Were they absorbing Christianity and kind of mainstream Protestant Christianity of the ilk that WCTU promoted. To what extent were they promoting the assimilation into the broader industrial capitalist society, or the market economy, the market farming economy, where they, you know, wanted to produce, you know, crops and livestock for the market. And they laud these things in their speeches and their newspapers, et cetera. Now, on the one hand, it's very easy to just look at this and say, okay, this is the product of complete manipulation. The children are simply doing what the authorities in power say because they don't have the ability to, or there's very little ability to resist in this situation. And certainly, you know, many of the other studies of boarding schools, Loma Wyma's book, they called it Prairie Light, you know, talks about how the kids were, you know, making beer and moonshine in the woods outside the school, outside of Chilocco. So while resistance certainly occurred and coercion was certainly part of the story, at the same time, some of these children, we can find a little bit of their background, or at least the background is in the story that they're writing about. And many of them are coming from families where alcohol abuse was a real problem. And so these temperance clubs, which were sometimes loyal temperance legions, that is the official WCTU kids groups, many of these that were at the boarding schools, I think many of those kids found camaraderie. They found a place where they could share some of their stories about how bad it was back home and make a commitment to not drink themselves. And they saw it as kind of legitimate. And they were affected positively by that. And evidence for that is that some of these are the individuals who end up in power in their communities later. There's a guy in the Seneca community who is involved at the Tunisasa boarding school, the Quaker school, and he later becomes involved in tribal government. So I think that some of these organizations, some of these kids organizations at the boarding schools, I think there was it served a legitimate need, and some of the children found solace or camaraderie among groups of people that may have shared similar traumas of alcohol abuse in their family communities. So I think it's a mixed, you know, you're left thinking that on the one hand, there's clearly coercion going on. Some of the stuff going on in the scientific temperance instruction definitely has an ethnocentric bent to it. But at the same time, I think the kids organizations did serve, you know, had some legitimate support for it among children.
And in the book, you really get a sense of you're grappling with how to interpret, you know, these writings of these students. And you face a similar challenge in interpreting Native women who are involved in the WCTU in general in the assimilation era. So could you talk about some of the ways that Native women, you know, redeployed or redirected what the organization from a national perspective was trying to do for their own ends and why they came to the organization in general?
Yeah. So, So a couple of things. I mean, one, the Native American women who left the most records, right? So Lila Lindsay, Lila Lindsay's obviously a big one here. You know, this was somebody who had already gone through the Euro-American educational system. You know, she was educated in white schools, and she was living a fairly middle class, even above that, lifestyle. And I think some over the course of their life had developed not only a thick skin, but also the ability to kind of use humor to shift conversations. One of the rhetorical devices I saw a couple times, and I mentioned this, you know, only briefly, was a couple different Native American leaders were quoted as saying, "I'm glad my people were on the receiving end when your people arrived." And this was in different, you know, totally different contexts. And I think sometimes there was an attempt to use humor in those public speeches to explain that there were connections between two communities. So I think, and then one of the chapters I begin talking about, there's a woman in Indian country, a white woman, And it's after the major floods of the white population into Indian Territory in Oklahoma. And she delivers one of the kind of very common horrible racist tropes that the WCTU leadership will use was when Native American men got the right to vote in certain areas, particularly in South Dakota, and ultimately in Oklahoma, they would use the WCTU leadership would compare well-educated white women to Native American men who didn't necessarily have the same Euro-American education, and they would say horrible things about those men's eligibility to vote. And this was coming out of obviously their frustration and lacking the franchise as well. So this one woman's giving this, you know, terribly racist speech, saying just like those things that we have for our political equals, children, the insane, and Indians. And she's delivering this speech in Indian country. And Lila Lindsay and dozens or hundreds of other Native American women are in the audience. And yet they are able to kind of continue on in the organization. I think part of this was, and that's not to say that they weren't furious. We don't have necessarily the anger that people felt when they heard those kinds of things. But what they left in their public records was not much commentary on those kind of racist elements that were there. On the other hand, what they then do, what I do think Native American women like Lila Lindsay saw was that the real practical problems of alcohol sales to Native Americans on reservations or in Native American communities that were off reservation was that they saw the drunkenness and the inability to work and provide for families and the domestic abuse. And they saw that as much more of an immediate problem and threat to their communities than any of the stuff that certain racist white women were saying. So I think they had developed probably a great deal of kind of mental toughness to overlook some of this stuff. But I think they saw the WCTU overall and their mission of trying to tighten up enforcement of laws, whether they be federal Indian laws or whether they be state laws in places like Oklahoma, or when they saw that certain allies of the WCTU, William Pussyfoot Johnson, the guy who's the federal inspector, he realizes that some of the Indian treaties had stipulations that even after the land was allotted, that those territories were supposed to remain dry in perpetuity. And so what that meant was they could use treaties in certain areas in order to create towns that were dry, even though the Native American population no longer held all the territory in those areas. So I think they saw either law enforcement, creative ways of extending jurisdictions, as William Johnson did, who obviously wasn't a WCTU member, but was an ally of the WCTU, or in their ability to try to educate the young in particular. I see those elements, reaching out to the young, creating organizations, creating an educational system in the boarding schools or the day schools where the children were compelled to attend. I think they saw the practical effects of curtailing, just the health from the drunkenness, the inability to work and thus provide for a family, and the domestic violence. I think they saw that all three of those social problems were majorly influenced by alcohol abuse, and thus they saw the WCTU as the most powerful ally in fighting for those things, even if some of the white women in those communities and those organizations said some terrible things and behaved in ways that were offensive.
It struck me in reading this book, you know, how Native women brought their own perspectives on seemingly every aspect of the organization, you know, women, Christianity, temperance, community. Can you talk about, with perhaps an example or two, how Native women brought their own perspectives to the organization and to its goals that they sought to achieve locally?
Yeah. So the one, and I think this is probably the best example I have of this, although there are other ones, is Lydia Pierce, and the how it worked, especially among the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois in New York State. So for those who aren't familiar, Iroquois or Haudenosaunee, by the time you're in the 1720s, you have six nations of Iroquois in New York State, and all of those nations have a series of clans that are matriarchal and matrilineal, and there is a system by which Native American clan mothers look around the community as children are growing. And they educate and guide these children who are going to ultimately become the male leaders in the community. And at some point in time, the women who are the clan mothers will select the people who will be the chiefs of their communities. But it's a longer process. It's not simply an election. It's an appointment by the clan mothers that occurs after a period of education of children. And over the course of their life, they are, you know, looking out for traits of leadership and looking for bad traits too, things that would preclude someone from a leadership position. And that one picture, it was actually sent to me by a friend of mine named Leslie Dunlap, who works also in the WCTU and their work in Native American and African American communities. And she sent me the picture. It was actually in Dorcas Spencer's collection out in California. And all it said on the back was Western New York Indian WCTU. But front and center is Lydia Pierce. And I looked closer at the picture, and I found, you know, I looked, and if you just kind of pass it by, you can just see all the women who are there. There's a bunch of older women in the back. And then there's some two boys and a girl who are up front. If you just look closely, they all kind of have some white thing on their shirt or dress. But when you look closer, the women all have white ribbons, which indicates that they're members of the WCTU. And the children all have medals, which means that they were involved in the medal contest. And this was the image that struck me so much, that some of the elements of Iroquois or Haudenosaunee matriarchy and matrilineal organization and the importance of women in raising future political leaders echoed almost exactly the message of the WCTU. The WCTU's motto for the Loyal Temperance Legion was "Tremble, King Alcohol, for we shall grow up." And the idea being was that these women who were unable to vote themselves, they were going to raise children. They were going to educate children along these temperance principles. And then those young boys who become men are going to vote for prohibition and probably suffrage. So that there was a sense of kind of raising children, raising young men upright by women was going to lead to the success of the community. And in a lot of the rhetoric, that's used, and it was particularly profound among the Iroquois communities in New York State, was that idea of raising future political, raising future leaders among the children, that was important. But the other thing was, and Lydia Pierce does this in a couple ways, most profoundly in a pamphlet that she writes. So this was something that was encouraged by Dorcas Spencer, but Pierce writes this, and she actually uses Haudenosaunee oral traditions, particularly the oral tradition of the foundation of the Iroquois League. That is how the original five tribes or five nations came together from a period of time when they were warring, and they came together in what became the Great League of Peace and Power. That oral tradition of nations coming together in order to be stronger together and fight some common foe. She uses that oral tradition in a pamphlet that she writes and then is sent out to South Dakota, where in South Dakota, the primarily Lakota people were going to be voting in elections for prohibition in South Dakota. And so she was using an oral tradition from her community to explain to another Native community why they should get involved in the prohibition fight. So the willingness to use the kind of parallels between training young men to go up and participate in politics in a righteous way, that was something I saw as, you know, very emblematic of the matrilineal matriarchal elements of Haudenosaunee communities, but also the willingness to use oral tradition and metaphors from their own traditions in their fight. I saw that as something that was, that was very common and very upfront, but it was probably most profound in that example with Lydia Pierce.
Your book sits at the intersection of a number of different historiographies, certainly, you know, the assimilation era and Indian policy, Indian boarding schools, you know, temperance and prohibition, gender studies, progressive era reform. Can you speak to some of the different audiences that you had in mind for your book and some of the ways you hope historians can benefit from looking at this organization and the perspective that you outline?
Okay, so this is the question where I'm going to get nervous. And so I'm going to give you my nervous response. So I am sure I stepped in it in some way or another in various places in this. One, there's so many different regions. There's so many different tribal communities, each of it which have their own both internal scholarship among the elders and the faith or tradition keepers in their communities. Then there's a whole host of scholars that study those communities. And likewise, there are people who deal with, feminist theory, and there's people who deal with, you know, government organizations, that is the Indian Office itself. So I'm sure that there are moments where I am missing something big. However, with that in mind, one of the things that I was really excited about with doing this was exactly that. That on the one hand, this was a wonderful opportunity for me, as somebody who does Native American history and teaches Native American history, to go around the country. And although oral history is only a very minute part of this, that is, some Native American people gave me very important information about some of the people involved in this. It really gave me an opportunity to travel to many different Native communities and try to learn specific histories about those communities. So on the one hand, I really hope that the book serves as a starting point for somebody else who wants to look more in depth at a temperance movement in their own community. So I really hope that would really be really kind of one of my joys that would come out of this. If some of the archival material that I kind of pulled out of the woodwork or pulled out of the microfilm machine, if you will, that provided kind of a framework or a certain way of thinking about things, if that could be juxtaposed or coupled with other people's work in a more focused way about some of these communities, I think that would be something that I would really be happy to see happen. I think that it connects a lot of different women's reform organizations, both Indian reform organizations or Native American reform organizations and non-Native reform organizations. So, for instance, the Women's National Indian Association, the Zions Conference of Mount Hermon in California, the Lake Mohawk Conferences of the Friends of the Indian, all of these organizations had some foot or another in the WCTU, or members of the WCTU had their foot in those. So I think that one of the things that the temperance movement does is it actually connects many of these organizations and many of those reformers. A couple places where I think that I was a little bit surprised, or where I think that there's actually kind of the next, you know, where I was left thinking, you know, if I had more time, I might want to explore this more, is I think that the WCTU, and particularly its Indian work, I think there's the ecumenical side of it, that is the social gospel Christianity. Certainly there's a lot of scholarship on social gospel Christianity. But I think the WCTU is a very powerful force in cementing that, because they're specifically running up against, that is fighting against, what is going to become the fundamentalist Christian movement. In fact, Frances Willard, especially I see it as later in her career, emphasizes and articulates, and Dorcas Spencer uses the same language, of Christian socialism. That is that these Christian organizations or these Christian churches have much more in common and doing the will of Jesus on earth in engaging in all these reform organizations. And so the WCTU is meeting at, you know, a Baptist church in Oklahoma, and then a Methodist church in Oklahoma, and then a Episcopal church. So there's a great ecumenical force going on in the WCTU. And I think that it's a more powerful force generally for American Protestant Christianity than maybe has previously been discussed. And I think that their work among Native Americans was a big part of that. And I think part of that has to do with the ecumenical or flexible nature of Christianity in many Native American communities, whereby people are going to Longhouse and then going to the Methodist Church. And many of the WCTU women had to kind of deal with that. Or the missionaries who were working in the Native American community, they saw overall temperance activity, regardless of what religious form it took, as having a positive social effect. So I think there's more going on, or there's more impact of the WCTU in both general ecumenical Christianity or social gospel Christianity, and I think Native American, their outreach to Native Americans is part of that. So I think that's a big part of it. I think one of the things that WCTU was so interested in with federal Indian policy was examples where Indian agents were corrupt or not. And so I think the book, by talking about what the WCTU was after, who they tried to get kicked out, who they were tried to expose, or who they lauded, because some of the women were politically well-connected. So they could write a letter to the governor of their state, who might be buddies with their husband, and that meant something. And or the senators, who obviously were active at a national level. And they were able to get certain federal officials ousted for, you know, either just bringing a bottle of booze onto a reservation to drink with his friends. That was enough to sometimes get people canned. Sometimes people were engaging in the alcohol trade itself, which was obviously both illegal and immoral from the WCTU's perspective. So I think the book also talks about or illuminate some of the examples of corruption that happens in the federal Indian office. So regardless of the kind of benevolent assimilationist aims of some people were doing that and were just downright corrupt and violating what was the intent of various Indian policies also. So you're right in that, I mean, the book by its nature jumps into a lot of different fields. But I also ended up being kind of hyper aware of the potential for danger, the danger when doing that. So I think, you know, those are my areas where I think that it really kind of touches on and makes a contribution. But I also hope that just kind of bringing forward some of the archival or microfilm material into what I hope is a coherent story can be a jumping off point for other either more focused studies. Or for studies that are, you know, more focused in one particular field, such as, you know, federal Indian policy or gender studies and feminist theory or local indigenous communities. Those are the places where I think that this might be a jumping off point for.
And now that this project is complete, do you have a new project that you're working on?
Yeah, so I guess part of me kind of gets dragged. Not, I don't want to say dragged, that's wrong. The more I think about the book or talk about it, you know, whether it's on campus or, you know, giving a book talk or this, I get excited about certain things that I feel like were unfinished or that there's more to do. There's certainly more to do. You know, the connection between John Collier and Stella Atwater and Stella Atwood and the Southern California reform movement. That's someplace that I could see being, you know, being interested again. I keep getting dragged back into certain things that I find interesting about, you know, the next step for this research. But the dissertation was left unfinished. So I feel like I have some unfinished business back in the 17th and 18th centuries that I'd like to revisit. Although certainly, you know, a lot's changed both in the scholarship and then in me in terms of interpreting it. So one step would be going back there. I have another idea for a project that has more to do, you know, so I've been teaching at Nazareth College now. I just finished my 17th year. So having taught college for a little bit and thinking about teaching and generational change within teaching, I have another project that that might look at that from multiple perspectives. It wouldn't just be about Native American or even American historical perspectives. It might be something that would be global in scale, which, of course, by dabbling into not only different areas of American history, but different nations or different countries or regions' histories, I'll probably open myself up to even more error. But I think I'd like to do something on teaching from a historical perspective in the future as well.
Well, that's wonderful. And it sounds like we have multiple projects to look forward to in the years to come. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thomas Lapas is a professor of history and political science at Nazareth College. His new book, In League Against King Alcohol, Native American Women and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, 1874 to 1933, is available from the University of Oklahoma Press.